Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. And here's CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger. So it looks like Joe and Kevin, or as I call them, Thelma and Louise, are about to step on the gas as they approach the cliff. And here's how I look at it, Jill. 14 years ago, when everything collapsed, there was somebody who said, okay, we have time. We can make it back in the stock market. That same generation looks at this and says, if it collapses this time, we have no time left. Maybe we should start pulling money out. So what do you do?
Don't pull money out. I think that the biggest risk in the debt ceiling standoff right now has not even been felt in markets, because there seems to be this collective belief that we're going to be okay. And I don't know if that's denial or if that's based in some reality, but there is definitely not a market reaction right this second. The moment that you start seeing the equities markets start to tumble in a very major way is when the phones will ring at lawmakers' offices. I promise you that. Mm-hmm. And that will be not just like, oh, I think I'll put some money in cash. That will be, oh, the S&P 500 just went down by 7% in 3 days, and people are going to be freaking out. And what happened in 2011 was that the Standard & Poor's ratings said that the U.S. debt was downgraded, and that downgrading of debt resulted in a 14% drop in 4 weeks of the S&P 500 stock index. Mm-hmm. And that caught everyone's attention and got everyone back to the table awfully quickly. So what I can say about this is that if the market does tumble, hang in there. You're going to be okay. It will come back. The bigger issue for me and the people who watch this very closely is that that can be a trigger for an actual recession. That actual sell-off, the debt ceiling standoff, could actually be the thing that triggers a real recession. And it would make it a worse recession than we would have felt otherwise. And that's the risk that we are seeing right now. The market risk is the one that's not as big a deal to me, because the markets will come back. The economy, not so sure how fast it'll come back.
So in terms of what a deal might look like to solve this, I don't know if you've looked at any the Republican proposals. I've certainly read the warnings from both sides about what might happen. So what would be wrong with Joe Biden being the guy to blink, because he's the adult in the room, and on the theory that, okay, once they actually start cutting the cops and cutting the teachers and kicking people off food stamps, whatever it is, then people will rebel and realize the folly of this?
I don't know about that. I mean, I think that there can be easy cuts to make. To me, neither side is really serious about any cutting, and is not serious about debt or deficit reduction. And do you know why we know that?
Why?
Because there are very major issues that are off the table. As soon as Kevin McCarthy said that Social Security and Medicare are off the table, as is raising taxes, then you are not serious about attacking the deficit or the debt. Mm-hmm. The only way that we can attack the annual deficits and the total amount of debt is to look at these programs and to raise taxes. That's it. Frankly, the Medicare and Medicaid side of this is difficult because it's healthcare, and healthcare is tough, right? But if we just use Social Security as the ideal way to kind of view the entire lens of debt and deficit reduction, if you are unwilling to raise the FICA tax, raise the wage base, or raise the retirement age, if those things are off the table, then you're not fixing the problem. So in 2033, when a bunch of people start retiring, right, the beginning of Gen X starts to retire, the end of the baby boom is over, there will only be 3/4 of the amount that is due to those people available. So either those people will make 3/4 less for the rest of their lives. I've heard those people will vote. or we'll do something prior to that. And it does not make sense to me that when you take those things off the table, you are not serious. Either side, not serious.
All right. So this is where we are. What is the what's the absolute latest they could come to an agreement and avoid a catastrophe?
I don't know. I don't know. Maybe Janet Yellen has given us a false deadline. I do that a lot with friends of mine who run late all the time.
You just automatically tell them to arrive 10 minutes sooner. And
Yeah. I'll say like, oh, we have a 7:15 reservation. And I always know it's, you know, actually a 7:30 reservation because they're always 15 minutes late. I don't know. I mean, I'm in this in terms of, in terms of information, I know as much as we all know, which is they have said around June 1st, which, that seems pretty close. That seems like 8-9 days away. So, I guess they got to get busy, or they'll do this like annoying thing where they're like, we're going to extend it for 30 days or 60 days. And then all of a sudden I'll be on vacation and I'll get called back to work.
Can I ask
you?
Isn't
it about me?
Well, yes, usually it is. The one, I tell you one that genuinely does confuse me. When I hear Kevin McCarthy say, and one of the things we're going to do is cut that appropriation for the IRS agents. I went back 2 years ago. It was Trump's commissioner of the IRS who said that there is $1 trillion a year in uncollected taxes because of lack of enforcement.
Yeah.
Who in their right mind would basically cut the IRS cops whose job it is to bring in all that money?
And also, wait a second, not just the people who bring in the money. I get the money, but what about the service? We have been like killing ourselves over the last 3 years since COVID, where we said, oh my God, people are waiting for their tax refunds or anything that requires human ears and eyes and hands on their returns. They are seeing delays of 6, 9, 12 months. We can't have that. That is not a functioning system. So it is, yes, it's the revenue side, but it's the service side. And we really, it always seems so easy to beat up on the IRS. Come on now. It is enough already. You know, we have many civil servants who do fantastic jobs. I talk to them all the time on my show, and they just don't get support, and they certainly don't get respect. And I think that that's a shame. And you know what? We're going to go into Memorial Day weekend. We are very respectful of people in the armed forces. We should be as respectful for our civil servants.
CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Thank you, Jill.
Thank you.
Seattle is known for raucous sports fans, high-tech workers, outdoor enthusiasts, and increasingly young and talented international artists. Car News Radio's Heather Baugh spoke to two such artists who performed recently with the Seattle Opera.
Taking the stage for Seattle Opera, soprano Vuvu Mpofu.
My character is Violetta.
And tenor Duke Kim.
I play Alfredo Germont in the opera La Traviata.
The two play lead roles in Giuseppe Verdi's 1853 opera with the timeless theme of people falling in love and the forces keeping them apart. Mpofu hails from South Africa.
This is my first time in Seattle. This is my first time. This is my U.S. debut.
So of all the cities in the country, we get you first.
Yes.
Kim is also making his Seattle debut. Having grown up in South Korea, he tells me opera was not his first focus.
Honestly, from the beginning, no. I wanted to become a pop singer. I wanted to be a Korean pop singer, and I started taking lessons from an opera singer.
And in time, he embraced opera.
I think, honestly, my voice is suited better for the classical singing.
Little doubt about that. As for Mpofu, she was first exposed to opera at a school singing competition.
And I was like, oh my word, what is that?
She quickly borrowed a couple of opera DVDs.
La Traviata was the one that I put on first. And let me tell you, I was just, you know, I was taken to another whole world.
Now she and Kim are part of that world amid vivid sets, lush costumes, and the swell of the orchestra. And while they're pouring their souls out on stage, they're keenly aware of the audience.
When you feel the energy from the audience, it gives you a drive.
Well, I think Seattle audience is very energetic, and they give a lot. Because as a singer, you love it when the audience gives back the energy that you give them, because you can take that and give them even more.
Both give high marks to Seattle audiences and people in the city in general.
Oh, I love the city.
When you meet people, it has that warmth from people here, and I've been so lucky that I've been meeting wonderful people. So, yeah.
You know, it's so funny because we have the saying, the Seattle freeze, because people say it's difficult to make friends here, and the people are very off-putting and
That is no. That I haven't encountered that at all.
The two have wrapped their Seattle performances of La Traviata for now, but plan to be back whenever the Seattle stage welcomes them. They and I am sure the fans will be ready. Heather Bosch, Cairo News Radio.
They're very well received, Heather, I think.
They were. Well, they're fantastic. They're fantastic and very friendly themselves. You know, Uber drivers would want to take their picture with them. So, and take that, Seattle Freeze. There's no such thing.
Yeah. What did you think of the production?
It was amazing. It really was. This is one of the more popular operas to begin with. It's
clearly,
you know, very catchy. Your Earworm Today was brought to you by Verdi. But yeah, these young, talented artists, it's amazing.
Heather Bosch. Thank you, Heather. Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. There's a big debate in the healthcare industry over surgery versus stents when it comes to treating heart disease. Of course, as you know, I have some skin in this game. So let's page the doctor. Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD, and also cardiac surgeon. So, briefly explain the difference between getting a stent and getting a cardiac bypass surgery.
Right. So, that's a good place to start with this. So, if you have a so-called heart attack, it means that you have a blockage in your coronary arteries. And the coronary arteries are those blood vessels which actually feed the muscle of the heart. And we have multiple blood vessels on the surface of our heart that do that. And so, historically, the only treatment was to have open heart surgery, where you would have your chest open, you would be put on the heart lung machine, and then they would take a piece of vein from your leg or an artery from your arm, and they would bypass the blockage. That's why it's called coronary bypass surgery. They would bypass the blockage by taking blood coming off of your aorta and connecting it to the coronary artery beyond the blockage.
So bypass surgery is like a splice. And explain a stent.
A stent is like a chain link fence in a circle that's collapsed, and it's on a balloon, and you place this catheter with this balloon up through a blood vessel in the leg, up inside to the coronary artery, and you blow the balloon up, and it inflates the stent, and the stent opens up that blockage, and that's all that's involved. And so this obviously became very attractive because it's not a surgical procedure. You don't have to have your chest cracked open. You don't have to be placed on the heart-lung machine. And usually patients can go home in a day or two.
Right. And the question, since the invention of stents, is which one is better, which one lasts longer, which one is safer? And now we have a pretty good study from West Virginia University that shed some light on that.
Right. So there was a study done, and it was presented just recently at a meeting, the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, which is an organization I'm part of. It's made up of cardiac surgeons from around the world. And what the researchers in this study did was they presented what really turned out to be very compelling findings, where they compared the outcomes for patients who underwent coronary bypass surgery versus those who went stenting. And what they did was they looked at patients over about a three-year period, 100,000 patients who were Medicare patients who were 65 years of age or older. And they also ensured, importantly, that the groups of patients who underwent stenting versus those who underwent bypass surgery were well matched, so that you had like patient to like patient, not that one patient had diabetes and the other didn't, or one patient was 65 and the other was 85. So it was like-to-like patient. And importantly, what this team found was there was a significantly lower hospital mortality for the patients who underwent coronary bypass surgery compared to those who underwent stenting. And they also found that there was a reduction in the 30-day and three-year readmission rate for having another heart attack in the patients who underwent cardiac surgery versus those who underwent stenting. And the cardiac surgery patients were also significantly less likely to need any additional stenting or intervention on their coronary arteries during those 3 years. And most significantly, those who underwent the cardiac surgery procedure had a nearly 60% reduction in death at 3 years compared to those who underwent stenting. So this is actually a really, really important finding. There hasn't really, prior to this, been any good study that's actually compared the two to show whether in patients who have multiple vessels that are blocked, is it better to have surgery or better to have stenting?
Okay, so is it up to the patient to listen to this feature between the two of us and tell the cardiologist, hey, have you heard about this? Or does the cardiologist and the cardiac surgeon work together to do what's best for that particular patient?
Well, I think if there's a patient who's listening to this and they then have a heart attack tomorrow, I think it's very fair for them to say to their cardiologist, is it better for me to have a stent or is it better for me to have cardiac surgery? And I don't think it's unreasonable to say, I heard on the radio that maybe there's some benefits to having open heart surgery, as much as I don't really want to do that, as compared to having a stent, which is really, less invasive. But if the long-term outcomes are better, then I would rather have surgery than have the quick fix solution.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. And joining us now from the King County Prosecutor's Office is Communications Director Casey McNerthy. And this week, Casey, instead of a group of sentencings, we have the gunshot report. So you guys track it every time a gunshot is detected?
Every time that there's a report of it, the Prosecutor's Office looks at all the available data. And we get that in a partnership with law enforcement. There's 39 different law enforcement agencies across King County. And they send us that data. And then our crime strategies unit and Rafael Serrano, who is the person who works on it, he looks at every single report that comes in and then puts together an overall report every 3 months and every year to see what the trends are. And so there's good news and bad news when you look at the first 3 months of this year. Which one do you want first, the good news or the bad news?
Let's get the bad news first.
Well, the bad news is that there's only been the slightest possible decrease when you look at the number of people who died. Last year, in the first 3 months of the year, there were 22 people who were killed in gun violence homicides, and the number dropped, but it only dropped to 21. So it's not a tremendous drop like we'd like to see.
What's the good news?
The good news is the number of people who were shot and survived, that number dropped year over year from 91 to 52. And the number of shots fired overall also dropped. There was 384 last year. And in the same period this year, it dropped to 356. So it's not perfect, but it's slightly getting better.
Right. And here's your boss's comment on those lower numbers, King County Prosecutor Lisa Mannion.
We can all acknowledge that we still have important work to do, working in collaboration with law enforcement and community to make sure that these numbers keep going in the right direction.
Can you really link the numbers to any particular initiatives that the prosecutor's office is conducting?
We'd like to on the good news, but I'm not sure that would be fair. I think it's really more of a collaboration. It really is both law enforcement and them getting us good cases and the community groups that are out there trying to prevent this violence before it happens. And it's hard to quantify that. I think really what we've got to do is watch until the end of August, because that will determine how the rest of the year goes. It's the busy season for shootings and all kinds of crimes.
Yeah, I know it's the busy season. So you mentioned that the gunshots go up the better the weather is.
Yeah, there also are exceptions. You know, we had a 3 week period in Seattle where there wasn't a single homicide, which was great, and there wasn't terrible weather then. But generally, when you look at the hotter weather, the summer months, the more people are in small and large gatherings, the more likely there is to be a shooting.
And what are the programs? I mean, what would we consider an intervention that has actually helped change these numbers?
And that's part of what's hard to quantify, but I think there's two different ways to look at it. One of those ways is with law enforcement, being proactive and trying to stop things from getting worse when they get a call, when there's an argument or a fight or, you know, a scene that you just sense could lead to a shooting, or trying to proactively address people who have warrants. The other one that's equally as important is when you see people who are reached out to bi community groups to say, hey, we know from reports that you've been around shootings and you've got this lower level offense that's not violent, and we think there's a better way. We want to give you some hope so you don't end up in another report, either as the shooter or the person being shot. You know, having those two ways to try to address people to say, hey, there's a better way here. And then ultimately, if people still do use guns and shoot them and hurt others, then those cases come to us and we file them.
And where do most of these shootings happen? I guess the big question is downtown Seattle as unsafe as some people seem to think it is?
Well, I think the answer to that is it really is as unsafe as you feel that it is. And, you know, whether or not the numbers are high or low, it's that feeling of safety that people have to have. But when you look overall, it's primarily 8 different agencies that have the bulk of these shooting reports. The Seattle Police Department being one, and the King County Sheriff's Office, which has 13 contract cities, and transit being the other big one. But it's also Auburn and Renton and Tukwila, Des Moines, Federal Way, and Kent. Those 8 areas are the highest percentage.
And where do the guns come from?
Hard to say. We know that every day we're charging crimes that involve stolen guns. That's a big part of it. And it's unfortunately way too easy to get a gun. And anecdotally, as we see more CPLs, more concealed pistol licenses, more gun purchases, which certainly have gone up each year over the last 5 years, the more availability there is for guns, the more guns get stolen, and then we see them in other crimes.
And then you have the ghost guns, which we've been hearing a lot about. And let's hear from Rafael Serrano. He's the data analyst in charge of tracking these incidents.
We are concerned about ghost guns and gun conversions. We just had a meeting with our ATF partners and some folks that have come down from Canada because they're seeing it more than we are right now. It's easier to purchase an actual firearm here, so there isn't necessarily a need to make your own or to convert something like an airsoft like they do in Canada. So when the border closed for COVID, the guns were more difficult to get up there, and that's when they started to see an increase in privately manufactured firearms or ghost guns and conversion.
And you've talked about, you know, attempts at violence prevention and stopping fights from escalating. Can you point to any common factor that seems to escalate these conflicts up to the point of actually needing to, somebody feels they need to kill someone to resolve it?
You know, the common thread, I think, that even Rafa would say too, is the availability of guns. You know, things that in years past would have been a fist fight turn into fatal shootings or life-changing shootings if you survive, just because there's the availability of guns. And those are very often stolen, and it's a big concern. So trying to do what we can to address that before it happens, as difficult as it is the key.
So it still comes down to that, because that's going to be really tough. We know how many guns are out there, and as you say, how easy they are to get and to convince young men. I guess that's the thing that I notice in the stats. It's mostly young men. That's the problem.
It's mostly young men, predominantly under the age of 24, and more than 70% of the shooting victims are people of color. So it's really concerning when you see those numbers.
And so who are the role models teaching these young men that a gun is the way to resolve things?
Well, it can be any number of things. Sometimes it's gangs. Sometimes it's people who just have guns in their home and their own record. It's often domestic violence.
Can you show any evidence that these young men, before they shoot, are thinking, boy, the consequences if I get caught are going to be severe, so maybe I better not shoot somebody? Do the consequences have an effect?
It's kind of case by case. I think some people would say yes. A lot of people would say no. And it really varies. But that's why you've got to have community groups and law enforcement together reach out before it gets to that point. Because when you're in that argument, I mean, anybody who's been in an argument knows that you're not thinking clearly when you're at your most frustrated. And when you get a gun involved, it makes things worse. And so trying to get to people before they hit that boiling point is really the only way that we can effectively, consistently get these shootings to go down.
Casey McNerthney from the King County Prosecutor's Office. Thanks, Casey.
Thanks a lot, Dave.
Time for your daily dose of kindness. It's brought to you by Robert W. Baird. In Galveston, Indiana, everyone has something nice to say about a man named Alan. CBS's Steve Hartman wanted to know why.
So who is this great humanitarian who lifts up the people of Galveston? The same man who puts them down. Meet 89-year-old gravedigger Alan McCloskey. Alan has been at this job since 1952 and refuses to retire because he says a new gravedigger might not square the corners as precisely, might not care as deeply for all those loving souls.
Yeah, people that have went to school with and worked with.
What was your hardest one?
My wife.
How'd you get through that?
I figured she'd want me to do it.
Alan and Barbara had three kids, but his definition of family extends well beyond blood, which may explain why a good chunk of the town gathered recently for what Alan thought was someone else's birthday party, but was really a celebration of him. At the party, he got an official Guinness World Record for longest career as a gravedigger, 70 years and counting. But more importantly, he was recognized for the thousands of odd jobs he's done for people. It's his side hustle, but with a twist.
We'd ask Alan for a bill, and he wouldn't give us a bill.
Never get a bill. You know, I'll send you a bill.
He said, I'll just catch up with you later.
And then
later never came.
You never hear anything more about it.
Alan McCloskey, unassuming by profession and persona, but also a bold beacon for anyone in search of meaning.
Alan has figured out what life is about. It's not the money that makes him happy. I truly believe Alan has figured out where enough is at. He's found enough.
And strange thing about finding enough, you often end up with more than enough. Steve Hartman on the road in Galveston, Indiana.
7:48 and now from the Gene Ursula Show. It starts at 9. Here is G. Scott.
Good morning.
That's a heck of a house that Beyonce and Jay-Z have.
Man, shoot. I mean, what are we gonna, 30,000 square foot home, Colleen. $200 million. Oh, they got a deal because it was listed at $295 million. And so what they did was, is they said, okay, $295 million. What about $200 million cash?
Ooh. Yeah,
and we're gonna give you $200 million cash. We'll take that off your hands. So they have this new Malibu estate down there for $200 million. It is 30,000 square feet.
It's an all-concrete structure. I was just looking at, not enough pictures, by the way. I need more pictures of the inside.
There's a ton
of pictures of the outside.
Yeah.
And it took 15 years to build it.
Jeez.
Japanese architect.
Yeah.
How many bedrooms does it say?
It's gorgeous. I don't know. It doesn't say. That's the frustrating part, is that there's very few details like you usually get.
Basically, aren't homes like that sort of glorified private hotels for your friends?
Yeah.
You know, all the rooms have bathrooms. And
so... Here's where we're at, because this is my favorite part of any of these types of discussions, because people will say, G. Scott, you're a hater. I'm not a hater. But here's what I don't think. I don't think that we should allow these types of purchases. I don't think...
Not allow them?
Excuse me. Hear me out.
I'm listening.
We have already a housing shortage, especially on the West Coast. We have a housing shortage, and because of that, we have housing that is going through the roof, that they're young 20-year-olds, young Gen Z, who are maybe making $80,000, $85,000 a year, $100,000 a year, yet, but they still can't afford a home because we have things like this. All I'm saying is look, have your money, have your riches, but you just should not be able to do this. We're in a planet where on this world, we have 8 billion people in the world. 8 billion. We have 2,600 billionaires.
We have that many.
8 billion people. We have 2,600 billionaires in the world.
But what are these people supposed to do with their money then?
Go buy you some avocado toast and lattes. You feel me?
You don't need to be a billionaire to do that. The reason to become a billionaire is so you can buy giant houses, yachts, and planes.
Okay, Dave. I know you're playing devil's advocate, so I'm going to ask you.
Yes.
Does someone need
Of course not. Do people need three cars? Do people need 44 shoes?
We don't have it, but we don't have a.
But it'd be like somebody telling you, like, why do you spend all that money on shoes, G, when people are going hungry?
But we don't have a supply and demand problem with shoes and or cars.
Yeah,
we have a problem with. We do have a problem. That's a good topic. But yeah. We do with housing, though.
Yeah, but what I mean, the house is already built. What are they going to do, right?
Well, divide it up into apartments.
Ah, make an apartment. That's what happened during the Russian Revolution.
They took all the palaces and divided them.
Look,
oh, that's cool.
I don't. Here's what I've learned about when you go to folks' house, right? Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, Billy and them, they got a 7,000 square foot home. Oh my gosh, Lois and them got a 5,000. No matter how big your house is, everybody always hangs out in one common area.
Yeah.
Right? So I don't know where your common area is, but usually for folks like me,
kitchen.
It's the kitchen, right. It's the island, and it's close to the fridge.
Yeah.
That's all you need is a kitchen and some tents out back.
What do we need? We don't need 30,000. So how about this? Can we do this, y'all? Mm-hmm. Can we cap it? Can we cap it at about 10?
Then what
maybe
are we supposed
12,
to strive for? What are young Americans supposed to strive for, Gene?
Strive
we're
for
supposed to see these billionaires and say, I want to be a billionaire. I just saw a picture somebody posted of Jeff Bezos at his very first desk. He used a door, and it's on, like, you know, some filing cabinets, and now he's the richest man in the world. It's so we have people to look up to, the billionaires. They're the ones that we want to follow.
Did y'all see Jeff and Lauren? They was on that $500 million yacht.
Yeah.
$500 million yacht.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
We
could only hope.
Plus the spaceships and all the rest
I'm
of that
I'm hoping
stuff.
One day to make it rich in radio.
It's been waiting a long time. It's jobs, G. The jobs to build these houses, to build the yachts, to build the spaceships.
All you have to do, if you want to be a billionaire, if you want to be one of the 2,600 billionaires in the world of 8 billion people, mm-hmm. Just work harder.
Yeah, that's
work
right. Harder. Bootstraps.
Or underpay your employees.
Anyway, in the meantime.
From Nick. Commentary from Nick.
Hold on. Hold on. Nick came from like Steph Curry from three.
From downtown, baby.
See you guys.
See Scott with Ursula at 9 o'clock. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. We are both on the air, and as it turns out, so is your DNA. And that came out in some research done by Dr. David Duffy, who is a bioscientist at the University of Florida. And Dr. Duffy, you were originally out to study sea turtle migration, and you eventually found out that your DNA samples were being polluted with human DNA. Tell me about that discovery.
Well, initially, we're using environmental DNA, which is just a technique to recover DNA from environmental samples, from water, from air, to study wildlife and other animals. It's a good let you know where they are and what areas need protection based on how many individuals might be in that area. But as part of that, while we were just doing initial tests to make sure everything was working well for sea turtles, we have sea turtles here at our facility in rehabilitation tanks. So they're sick animals that we're helping to get better, which will get released back into the environment. So this was an ideal situation for us to try out these techniques. So as we were looking for sea turtles, we were also looking to see what else we could find in these samples. So we had samples from patient tanks, and we had also had samples from out in the environment. And we thought one of the things we would find was probably a little bit of human DNA. We expected that there would be more human DNA in our tanks than there would be in the environment. But what we found was actually the complete opposite, that we had large amounts of human DNA out in the rivers around our facility, whereas in our tanks, which is a human facility, our sea turtle patients are actually cancer patients, so they require a lot of hands-on care. Mm-hmm. But we were picking up a lot less human DNA in the tanks, which is a complete opposite to what we expected to find.
Now, finding human DNA in waterways, I'm familiar with the idea of, for example, sampling sewage to see, track the progress of disease. But you were finding them in what, streams, creeks, where?
Yeah, so in creeks and rivers, even a little bit in the ocean as well. Mm-hmm. So we do think that a lot, unfortunately, of the DNA that we're getting in water bodies is coming from improperly treated wastewater, from septic tank leaching as well. So we think that is a major source. So there's potentially a benefit here where we can identify sources of pollutions and hold humans accountable if it's a human source and indicate areas that need to be cleaned up.
Do you actually get enough human DNA to identify who it is if they were in a database somewhere?
I should clarify. I don't mean identifying an individual, but what happens is if you have pollution in an area, there's a couple of different possibilities of where that comes from. It could come from agriculture, it could come from wildlife, or it could come from human wastewater. So everybody will point the finger at everybody else and say, it's not us, it's the other person's problem. So with these approaches, we can definitively say whether or not that waste is human origin or not, which means that we can say it's definitely the wastewater system that's causing a problem as opposed to its agricultural runoff or some other source.
As you began to analyze this human eDNA, what were you able to deduce? Did you find disease? Did you find certain characteristics about this human DNA?
Yeah, so once we realized how much human DNA was out there, the next question was, well, what's the quality of that DNA? What can it tell us? And this is a question we ask all of the time for wildlife. So we were really curious for humans what sort of information we could recover. So one of the things we did was genetic ancestry analysis. So we were able to figure out essentially the genetic ancestry of the individuals whose DNA had been released into the environment. So there is the possibility that in future with further refinements, you might be able to take it further to an individual level. We didn't attempt to do that because at the same time as realizing we had this DNA out there that had all of this information in it, we were also realizing obviously this has a lot of ethical implications as well that nobody's considered before. So we were reluctant to try and take it to the level of individuals, but we did for proving how much information is in there. We did show the genetic ancestry of the people whose DNA we had recovered.
Now, tell me about the technology you use, though, because you've got to go through a lot of water and process a lot of little tiny snippets of DNA, which would sound like a time-consuming process, but apparently you can just like attach a little thumb drive-sized device to your computer.
Yeah, so the surprising thing is we're getting all of this information not from liters or gallons of water, we're getting it from milliliters of water. So for one of our samples that had the largest amount of human DNA in there, we only had about 200 milliliters of water, so less than a soda can. And we were able to recover genetic ancestry, we were able to recover mutations, which may tell you something about the medical disease susceptibility of those people as well.
Wow.
So it's really small volumes of water. We're not filtering entire rivers to get at this information. And then the technology has gotten so advanced that we do have essentially DNA sequencing machines, which are now the size of thumb drives, that were telling us all of this information, not just about humans, but also all of the other species in that sample. And they're incredibly fast now. So you can sequence all of this information in 1 or 2 days, essentially.
And it's not just water. You reported in your paper that you can pluck it out of the air.
Absolutely. So there's a big push for wildlife DNA now looking at what information is on the air. So we used to think there wasn't all that much DNA in the air, except maybe pollen and certain plants. But what people have been showing very recently is that you can recover vertebrate, so animal DNA from the air as well. So we are very curious to see, was this the case for human DNA also? So we tested some of the rooms at our institute, and indeed we were able to, with minimal sampling, collect human DNA out of those rooms.
Given what you can grab from the air and from the water, there has to, you alluded to it, the serious ethical implications of this if the machine that you use or the device you use ends up in the wrong hands.
Absolutely. So there's lots of questions ethically. Who owns that information? Do you need consent to collect that information? And if you need consent, how do you get consent from a population that you're not even sure whose DNA is contributing? And there's actually a lot of beneficial applications. There's medical applications that can flow from this, but equally, there are more worrying applications if this technology does end up in the wrong hands.
Not that police officers are the wrong hands per se, but you know, I think that they have been using the DNA technology to catch and prosecute cold cases. But if all of a sudden they're grabbing your DNA out of the air to implicate you at the scene of a crime, is that on the horizon?
These technologies have been used to solve crimes, which is a great thing. But when you add in environmental DNA, there's a couple of added considerations. So you are recovering DNA from a room. Is that really from a suspect or is that just a bystander? Either way, you've generated information on their genome without consent. So then what happens to that information? Does that end up in a police database or does that get filtered out? So there's a lot of questions that need to be answered. Whether it's suitable for forensics, a lot of investigation would have to be done before we could confidently say that, yes, this technology could be used for forensics, but it is a possibility, especially as these technologies continue to become more advanced and give us more sensitive results.
What are the ethics of identifying human genes found in the environment? Colleen and I talked with Dr. David Duffy of the University of Florida, who was studying sea turtles when human DNA started showing up in his samples. High-quality human DNA, enough not only to potentially identify individuals, but even detect genetic diseases. And that's when he decided it was time to take a step back.
Yeah, it was slightly uneasy, in fact, that we weren't sure how far we should go. So what we did, as soon as we realized how much information we were getting, we kind of pressed pause. We considered it from an ethical standpoint, and then we went and treated the rest of the study as you would a real human study. So we went and got ethical approval. We recruited participants. So the DNA we were recovering from Rumor was from people who had consented to enable us to do that. So we are no longer recovering DNA from the general public. We were recovering DNA from consenting participants.
It reminds me of sort of the old days when you could pick up somebody's phone call through a signal, and then you're almost eavesdropping on a conversation. You don't know the people. They're complete strangers to you. It's going out over the, but you're listening to this intimate conversation and you want to because it's interesting, but you know you shouldn't. That reminds me of what you went through.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a really good analogy.
I have to think that every spy agency on the face of the earth has got a whole slew of these thumb drives, and they are just salivating over ways they could use them.
It's possible. I mean, there's lots of good potential uses for this. So, for instance, helping to identify missing persons is a positive application.
Right.
Helping to identify the remains of fallen soldiers or other people that you are essentially trying to repatriate or relocate. So there are plenty of beneficial applications, but we are sending out a call for people to really pay attention for this and decide what society believes this should and shouldn't be used for and where the lines should be.
I mean, potentially, you said that you picked up some DNA snippets which indicated that whoever's DNA it was had a genetic disease. So I suppose that one day any of us could get a call out of the blue saying, by the way, you know, it's like finding somebody's wallet. I found your DNA, and it turns out you better go in for a heart operation or something like that.
Yeah, so most of what we looked for was risk factor for diseases as opposed to diseases themselves, because it was the same question. Should we know if we don't know who the person is, but should we know if there's people in this population who have diseases, especially if those diseases are incurable? So we tried to focus there on certain things that increase your risk of disease, because that information is, I guess I rest a little bit easier knowing that information than having concrete evidence that somebody that contributed to that DNA in that river has a specific disease. But in theory, you know, you could take the medical side further as well.
What's the next step for you?
So that's a really good question. I mean, at every stage, this was essentially a side project of ours. We did it out of curiosity, and then we realized the large societal implications, and we wanted to draw attention to them. So there's a couple of things that this study does. One of them is it tells us what the future of wildlife eDNA is. So things that we can do with humans now are things that we can do with wildlife genetic information in the very near future. So it tells us how informative wildlife eDNA is. So that's definitely something we continue to study sea turtles and their diseases using environmental DNA. But we're also considering some of the beneficial applications. So some of the medical applications that can fall out of this. You can use this sort of technology now to, at the same time, examine the level of a pathogen or a virus in a given room, whether that's in a hospital or a community setting like a lecture theater, while potentially also looking to see how susceptible the people in the room are to that particular virus or pathogen. So we're really considering all of the possible options that have been opened up and which ones we should really be focusing on in the future.
So you could have one of these things just sort of out in the air running, and it could sound like the COVID alarm sirens could go off when we detect the next disease?
So right now you need a lab still to do the processing, but things are progressing very rapidly. These sequencers have been brought to rainforests and up mountains, and sequencing has been done in the field. So that has been developed to enable people to take research out of the lab, but you still need a trained scientist. But given how fast a lot of our computational tools are advancing, how fast a lot of our sequencing tools are advancing, we could foresee in the future where, yes, you could have essentially an early warning detection system for diseases, or something like a Star Trek tricorder where you can scan for life forms. So it's science fiction, but it's not as much science fiction as we thought it was maybe 5 years ago.
Good point. Dr. David Duffy, University of Florida bioscientist. Dr. Duffy, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM, or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.